I am Charlie Bennett, and this is the North Avenue Lounge. Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge. My guest today is Atlanta information architect and artist, Mark Denard. Mr. Denard earned his bachelor's and master's degrees from Georgia Tech. You'll hear about Georgia Tech, architecture, digital media, painting, and a special hat today. And we'll play you a song from Tom Waits. That's all coming up on today's North Avenue Lounge.
You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta.
My guest today is Mark Denard. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, Charlie. How are you?
I'm doing good. So we've been talking a lot today before starting the show. And I think we've discovered the best way to start this is to say, why Georgia Tech? Why architecture?
Well, really, for me, the question of architecture came first. When I was a kid, I think I went through most of the same sort of, you know, questions that a lot of kids go through when they are thinking about what they want to do when they grow up. You know, a lot of folks go to their parents. You know, I think for a minute there I wanted to be a doctor because my mother was a nurse, something like that.
Did you get fireman and astronaut in there also?
Astronaut, probably.
Yeah.
That was probably there. At one point, but really, for me, I really enjoyed drawing. I drew all the time, mostly sort of Frank Frazetta-based fantasy stuff, and also frankly, firearms. My father was a gunsmith, and I saw those things around a lot. So
drawing guns, you were actually doing sort of technical drawings.
It was more like drafting at some point. Yeah, and it became a kind of a design thing.
And who was that artist you mentioned?
Frank Frazetta. He did a lot of the old Conan the Barbarian book covers that were around when I was a kid, all over bookstores and stuff.
It was almost stylized.
Extremely stylized, sort of, you know.
Looked a little bit like photos, almost. They had that kind of
They were photorealistic,
feel,
yeah. For sure. And I, you know, at the time was very into that kind of stuff, you know, as a kid. I had wooden swords and all that, like a lot of kids, but... That's sort of where I got started thinking about designing things, although I wouldn't have ever called it that.
You were making up your own weapons, your own swords, your own...
Yeah, and then that branched off then. And in particular, I remember in the fifth grade, we had this strange competition at my school that it was called Hat Day. This is really odd, but basically every kid was supposed to make a hat that was... supposed to represent what they wanted to do when they grew up.
Did you ever find out where that came from? Or you said you think it was really weird, but
did it
ever make sense later?
To me, it still doesn't make any sense. I think it was just something that they made up to get kids thinking about their future, but also that would be a little bit silly because, I mean, I can imagine as an adult how hilarious would it be to see a bunch of kids running around with funny hats.
You can make a very goofy hat. Yeah.
And I actually made one of the goofiest. I also had some kind of report to do, and I was back in those days. This was before the internet. This was actually before computers were ever in a household. Mm-hmm. It was pretty rare, and if you had a report to do of some kind, that meant you go to the encyclopedia somewhere in your house. There was a bookshelf with a set of encyclopedias.
Oh yeah, the big long line.
Absolutely, and you know, I think we had two of them, two different sets of some kind, and I was flipping through one. And came upon a photograph of the Guggenheim Museum, and I asked my mother what this was, and she told me a little bit about it, but, you know, essentially my mom had this tendency to go, well, if you want to know something, you go find out, right? And so I read a lot about it, and I was pretty fascinated by this building, because I would never have said this at the time, of course, because I was in the fifth grade, but... I was really fascinated by the way in which human beings could tame materiality in that way.
What was it about the Guggenheim picture that really caught you and made you think that?
Well, it's an extraordinary building in many ways, and not the least of which, because the architect, Frank Lloyd Wright, very famous American architect, had used the context of the building in a very different way from the way people typically mean, where you mirror the context of the buildings around it. He had purposely set it at a 45-degree angle to the street. It's vastly different from anything in the area, especially for the time. And it has a series of overlapping, fairly pure geometric shapes that I had never witnessed in a building. And I'm from a small town in Georgia, so, you know,
yeah,
it was a little bit like a revelation for me to see this building. And
because it was so different from what surrounded it, because it was so clearly someone's choice.
And because it was so different from anything I'd ever seen.
Okay.
It was remarkable. And long story short, I said, I want that. That's what I wanted to do. And I drew like that. You know, I drew from then on things like that. It was no more Frank Frazetta. It was no more guns. It was no more swords. That was over.
Now, I'm not going to let you get past here without telling the rest of the hat.
Oh, well, okay. Well, so, yeah, so I decided for my hat I wanted to make, basically, I put the Guggenheim Museum on top of my head.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It was ridiculous. And, I mean, I'd like to be able to say that I was proficient enough, you know, with making models and stuff like that, that I did it all by myself. I mean, the truth is my mother and my father did the lion's share of it, unfortunately. That's a little bit embarrassing, but I learned a lot from that experience, and I put that thing on my head and got my picture in the paper and won an award. It was thoroughly satisfying. One of the few things I've ever won in my whole life, unqualifiedly.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So when were you able to turn that knowledge of this is what I want into I want to be an architect?
I mean, it started fairly quickly. Like I said, my father is a gunsmith and a machinist. I mean, he's a thoroughly blue-collar guy, but to do those kinds of things, you have to know how to draft and stuff. And, you know, earlier I'd mentioned there was really nothing digital about any of this. You know, my uncle is kind of a jack of all trades, and he was a draftsman as well. And both my father and my uncle kind of influenced me here. I got a drafting table. I started learning how to draft parts. I mean, and this is fairly, I mean, this was maybe sixth or seventh grade. To some degree, in my spare time, if you want to call it that, you know. But
what about what year was sixth or seventh grade? You don't have to be exact.
That's none of your business. But it was sometime in the later 80s.
Okay.
Late? No, that's actually not true. It was sometime in the mid 80s.
Mid 80s. Okay.
Yeah. So, and you know, once I got to, I think middle school, eighth grade, is when you were able to take classes and that kind of thing. And I just, from then on, every single quarter, back then it was quarters, I was in a drafting class of some kind. I had art classes here and there, but those, you know, were really, art classes were oriented towards fine art. And so, you know. And, you know, I sponged every magazine I could find. I looked everywhere I could. I sketch stuff, you know, that was just, I was sold.
So by the time you hit high school, you were going to be an architect?
Oh, certainly, yeah.
And you started looking at schools. How did you end up choosing tech?
I looked at schools later in life. I don't think I really, early in high school, understood the gravity of the situation with respect to the rest of, you know, my life.
Wow, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. So it really was probably my junior year that I started to get serious, not about the work, but about, you know, picking a school. And I applied to several schools. A lot of them, well, they were all very good. I didn't have a fallback school. I would have been satisfied to go to any of them. But long story short, most of them were out of state. When I was 17, 18, I wanted to get as far away from my hometown as possible, like a lot of folks that age.
Mm-hmm.
And but Georgia Tech was in state. I'm from Georgia. And which made it a bargain, especially for the education, because it has a terrific reputation. Its undergraduate architecture program had a really strong reputation and was known for being a school that, for graduate school, which is kind of a requisite in those days for to become an architect, you would have to go to graduate school. And a lot of the great graduate schools were known to draw from the Georgia Tech undergraduate school, even above and beyond their own undergraduate program. Yeah. So that became one of the deciding factors. And then as far as it not being very far away, I decided that for a guy with no car, you know, a couple hours away is the same
far
thing
enough.
As 15.
No one's going to tell you that you have to get home.
Right.
You have to walk up 75.
Right, exactly. I mean, well, my father might have told me that, to do that, but he would have also known it wasn't going to happen. So
what was it like to arrive at Tech and start the architecture program after all of this buildup?
Terrifying and exciting. I came here the summer before the fall quarter at the time was that, and there were only a few freshman architecture students here. Literally fewer than a handful, maybe three, four, and all of those four people I became very good friends with over the years. But at the time, we didn't know each other, and one of them, who turned out to be one of my best friends, we despised each other upon sight. It's kind of a pattern with me, but with some folks, I won't like them immediately, and then we'll become fast friends. It's strange, but so I was in a freehand drawing class that was being taught by a graduate student, and it was one of the required courses, and it opened up a world to me because I was able to go and sketch in Midtown, which at the time was not what it's like today. It was a terrifying place, and this was in 92.
Terrifying how?
Well, I mean, Peachtree was lined with buildings that were being destroyed for new construction, but had not yet actually been knocked down. And so they were the world's largest crack houses at the time. Mm-hmm. And I can literally remember walking down Peachtree in my, you know, freshman grunge wear. You know, it was the early 90s, and some huge guy literally stepping through a broken window with his foot out the window and out, an enormous guy in overalls, and coming in and asking me for money and telling me he wasn't going to hurt me. And this man was sick. I mean, it was like that. That's what Midtown was like back then. And
was that your first experience with that kind of...
That literally was my first experience, that kind of thing. It was unpleasant, but it was obviously an eye-opening. No one got hurt. But yeah, that was it. And I lived in the old Techwood dorm. It was the last year that it existed before the Olympic Village was built, which is now the Georgia State dorms, I believe.
Actually, they've been switched back.
Oh,
Georgia
okay.
Tech owns those now. So if you're a student listening to this, the North Avenue apartments used to be Georgia State dorms and used to be
the Olympic Village. And before that was Techwood Homes, which had one dorm in it, which was... I mean, I actually wouldn't trade that year for anything. I probably learned the most about this city from living in that spot right there than I have lived in any single year since. So anyway,
you arrived here for architecture.
And when I said terrifying earlier, I wasn't referring to those things. I was referring to the way that at the time, at least, I don't know what it's like now, but at the time in the architecture department, I think the going policy was to shock every incoming undergraduate student into thinking that they would never survive this experience.
Oh, this is the speech.
Look
to your right, look to your left.
Exactly.
Only one of you will graduate.
Right, which is actually not a lie. It's not shocking. It does make you feel like a Marine, basically. because, you see some people that are scared. The truth is everyone is scared. Later you admit that to yourself. But some of us were... I don't know, more punk rock than others, and we're going to make that guy eat his words, you know, I guess. That's the way it started. And the first quarter after everybody got here, for me, was fairly easy because it was all that course. Now, I'm only talking about architecture courses because, you know, they really do pound you in that program, or they did at the time. And everything was drawing back then. Everything was done by hand. Nothing was done in the box. Nothing in the computer at all.
Nothing was done in the box?
No AutoCAD.
Okay.
At all. No 3D modeling.
Is that
nothing.
Called in the box?
That's what I say.
Okay.
I mean, I work in digital media now and on the web, and that's just my own, you know, jargon.
Okay. Hey, let's take a break, and we'll come back and we'll talk about that. So you are listening to WREK, and this is the North Avenue Lounge. Oh.
Rec Room Renaissance is Atlanta's premier outlet for old school and underground hip hop, funk and soul, turntablism, and spoken word poetry. Every Thursday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m., hear what's going on with hip hop in Atlanta, hear guest DJs and interviews with hosts Enchanted, A-Dot, Black Daniels, and more. That's Rec Room Renaissance, every Thursday night from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. It's not just a show, it's a movement. You're on WREK Atlanta.
And we're back. So we were just talking about, you came to architecture school back when everybody drew, no one typed.
Yeah, there was no typing, there was no mouse. In fact, in those days, I think a mouse was a little bit of a novelty still, to some degree. Email was, I mean, you felt like a wizard, right?
This is a bizarre land you're describing now.
Absolutely.
This world has nothing to do with what anyone understands anymore.
No, not at all. It wasn't exactly slide rules, but graphing calculators were really exotic back then.
Okay. Well, did that change over the course of... How long were you in architecture school?
I mean, I was in architecture school from 92 until early 97.
Was there a change during that time? Did it go from
it began,
paper to
it
computers?
Began to. Now, really, the change kicked in when I transferred into... Well, when after I graduated and was in graduate school. And after I'd worked for a bit in the industry.
Well, now, you didn't go to architecture graduate school.
No.
No, you changed up. What happened?
I did.
What happened
after
to architecture
such
school?
A committed sort of period, yeah. Even while I was in school, there were a number of, I don't want to call them incidents, but events that occurred in my time as an architecture student that cumulatively added up to me after working for a little while, considering doing something else. And mostly, you know, having to do with the way some of my work was received by professors and critics at the time. At the end of any project, the way architecture students are graded, I mean, they're graded by their professors, but you have to basically do an oral presentation to a panel of a jury, right? And you have your project critiqued, and these can be pretty brutal, at least back in that day. And, you know, I did a project that, I don't know if they still do it here, but at the end of your junior year, there's a competition called the VLUX competition, which is a skylighting company.
Is that VLUX?
No, it's VELUX.
That's a company?
Yeah, it is.
Cool.
In any case, they sponsored this competition. That was the program for the building was for a library with an extension for Southern literature that was going to be on the site of the Margaret Mitchell House, which at the time had just burned down, I think for the second or third time, I don't remember. But
that house has not had good
luck. Yeah, that poor thing. So it was going to be on that site, and this was my junior year. I had a philosophical awakening, and I that sounds pretentious, but I actually mean that. Really, my senior year in high school, based upon some incidents that happened while I was in high school, where I started reading a lot of philosophy, and that really opened a whole realm of stuff for me in architecture school. And in fact, I even for a moment considered not doing architecture in favor of sort of going in that direction, but until I discovered that philosophy is very bound up in architecture, especially back in the early 90s when there were a lot of critics and architects sort of looking at psychoanalysis and other things.
Really?
Yeah, very much.
Is that something that continues now? What?
Less so, for sure. And I think probably the more pragmatic and existential demands of sustainability have become much more of an issue today.
Okay.
Yeah. But back then, there was a lot of post-structuralist philosophy floating around. I was fascinated by it. I was really fascinated by the concept of instability. Which is obviously somewhat problematic and engaging for an architecture student.
Right.
And I was very fascinated by the concept of architectural representation and representation in general, meaning language, you know, literally words, language.
Symbols. And
yeah, absolutely. Semiotics. And for my VLX project, it became less about the building and more about the process, essentially. I was lucky enough to have a crop of professors that year who were excellent. Teachers, some of them, but managers of an angry young 21-year-old, all of them.
What does it look like when an angry 21-year-old concentrates on process more than the end result?
It means that you undermine the entire notion of process on some as it exists and in conventionally in the realm that you're working in, and try to reinvent it. I essentially tried to do something that is impossible, and I don't mean in that sort of climbing Mount Everest way. I mean in the sense that 2 + 2 cannot equal 5.
You're going to have to explain that. How did you try and make 2 + 2 equal 5?
Well, I tried to foreclose architectural representation in favor of some very philosophical notion, an artistic notion of how a building could be conceived. And really what I did, long story short, is I ended up, instead of drawing it, I ended up inventing a series of tools that were very prosthetic, that you could attach them to your arms and my arms, and that then allowed me to make these objects that I have to admit now that I actually think this exercise was really kind of cute more than serious.
Okay.
It allowed me to make these objects that really, I don't think I could have come up with them in my head. They didn't look like buildings. They were somewhat sculptural, but they were just very strange, that I then would expose onto photo paper and sort of consider those my drawings. And the jury for the project was brutal. It was considered a success by about half of the jury, and then the other half of the jury was just completely offended by what I had done.
Did you know that was coming?
I thought it was probably coming. I mean, I'd been warned by my professor. He was very candid with me about how this idea would probably go, and he supported me the whole way, because he felt like this was something that I thought I needed to do, and I did manage to actually learn a lot about architecture out of this process, and I did in fact design a building, but it was represented in a way that was very different from everyone else's, and how do you judge it, right?
Right.
The question became, look, we required you to do two plans, two sections, two elevations, a model, and, some other documentation. And what is all this stuff? And I had a series of things that could be called models. As I said, I had exposed all of these objects onto photo paper, which could be called sec. It became, to some degree, I think some of them found it to be a rhetorical exercise. And they were looking for things that could be called construction documents.
Right.
It was really kind of a process art piece.
Was this the end of your desire to be an architect?
No, I think that really happened while I was working for an architecture firm. And I have immense respect for the profession and for the people that do it. And I would not change my education for anything. Meaning I wouldn't, if I could go back, I wouldn't go to art school instead of architecture school. I would have done it the same way. But, I was working for a while for a medium-sized firm here in Atlanta. And I was thinking through a whole host of issues about architecture while being an AutoCAD jockey, basically.
And is that essentially a draftsman but on AutoCAD?
Yeah, on AutoCAD. And one day at a staff meeting, and I had graduated at this point, but I was taking some special topics classes here with the director of the IDT program here. And Balsamo at the
There's
time.
No IDT program anymore. Yeah, it is now digital media. So what was IDT at the time?
It's the forerunner of that program now, of the digital media program now. And it was an HCI degree, essentially. It had very close relationship to the College of Computing. But
HCI is human computer interaction.
Yes.
And IDT was
information design and technology.
Okay.
And so but also there was a lot of heavy cultural theory in there, a lot of philosophy if you wanted it to be, which I did. And I was taking some special topic classes from the woman who was then the director of the department in that summer. And, the web, this was now in 96 and 7, sometime in there. And the web had really hit the popular consciousness, at least in academia, in a big way. And digital media in general had hit in a big way.
I seem to remember the first time I bought a book on Amazon was 97.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Yeah.
And, I was in a staff meeting at my job, and somebody said, well, what's this website stuff? One of my bosses. So this is like a 60-year-old architect in 1997 or 6. And he goes, what's this website stuff? I had been hired to build models and be an architect.
It sounds like a sitcom scene.
It really sort of was, except that these guys were very serious, right? And somebody goes, well, we don't know, but we can get the intern on that.
And you were the intern.
I was the intern. And they were like, go figure that out. And I did, and I came back, and I said, well, we should probably get a website. And they were like, what's that? And I explained it to them. They're like, well, what do you need? And I was like, well, it looks like I'll need something called Photoshop and something called BB Edit.
And so this was a transition into a new, almost new career that didn't...
Very much.
You didn't know what was happening at the moment.
The irony is in the jury for that Velux project that we were just discussing, I said the jury was kind of divided.
Yeah.
Right? One of the people who maybe hadn't appreciated what I had done so much had, you know, architects can be really brutal in critique. And this guy was a professor who he had said, you know, I don't know if architecture is really for you. I think maybe you need to get into art or some kind of cyber. And he was very dramatic. He was making fun of me. But the irony is that's exactly what I did. Yeah.
So when did you make the choice to do IDT?
It was the summer after the BB Edit episode. Yeah.
Did you like doing that work, the website work? Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed it. I was more fascinated by the way that I felt the web could transform communication amongst people, really. And also because I was sort of floating around all these IDT people and professors and stuff like that, and I was really into art, and at that time I sort of finally made that jump at some point, and just decided to kind of admit to myself that that's what I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I decided to go into that program.
Okay. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about IDT at Georgia Tech back in the late 90s, long ago.
Hey, this is Zach Miller, and you're listening to WREK Atlanta.
And we're back with the North Avenue Lounge. My guest today is Mark Denard, a Georgia Tech alumnus of the College of Architecture and the School of IDT. Would that be right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, in the LCC department. So tell me about this major that no longer exists here.
It's a master's program. And I think at that time, a lot of schools were struggling to figure out what they needed to do in order to engage with this field without, in terms of...
This field being web design?
Well, it's a very wide swath of stuff, right? Because, I mean, at the time, it was very logical to say that, well, the College of Computing handles that stuff, right? But at the same time, I think there were a lot of folks who felt that design in particular was very important, and also design with a certain eye towards usability and sort of an eye towards the culture at large, in general, and with this maybe a certain philosophical outlook. And I think that program grew out of a lot of those concerns.
And did this fit your understanding of yourself? And
very much, yeah, at the time. Mm-hmm. And so, I dove in. I mean, and for me, what was interesting about it was because, architecture school had been such a mental and physical grind, literally working 40, 50 hours, a week in a studio while having classes on top of that, while having jobs on top of mm-hmm. that, all that kind of stuff. And graduate school then to me was a little bit like, playing in a meadow, after a war or something. Which isn't to say that it was easy. It wasn't easy, but it was very fruitful and fun, and it just didn't have the same qualities that made me feel like a Marine when I was in architecture school. Right?
And if I remember correctly, you managed to bend that department or bend your course of study to be a little bit more like your architecture.
Yeah, very much so. And the irony, I mean, the funny thing is, it's not ironic at all, but I did the same thing in the architecture program towards the end when I was sort of taking classes up there. You know, there's kind of a story about that VLX project where essentially there's an award on the books now down there for that project for special mention for creativity that they started because of my project, essentially. Like, there's no way I could win that competition. It's not to say that I would have if it had been allowed, but basically the chair of the jury said, look, people need to be thinking this way.
Nice.
Let's at least acknowledge that they need to be thinking this way. And I kind of did the same thing up in the IDT program.
Yeah, I'm thinking of your master's thesis.
Yeah, sure. My master's thesis was somewhat controversial also. I think there was a – when they – my thesis advisor, a guy named Matthew Causey, teaches at Trinity College now. He said that – he told me the story of when they were going through and trying to improve all the thesis proposals. There was a professor who was fairly new to the department, didn't know me very well, when they were reviewing it, and they reviewed my thing, and she said, well, does he know that this will not get him a job? And every single professor in the room said, yes, he knows it will not get him a job.
Why? Can you explain why it wouldn't get you a job?
Okay, well, so I was much more interested in – I mean, at the time, I thought – I actually was thinking that I might go into academia. And so the notion that I needed to do a master's thesis to get me a job at that time when people were getting jobs who didn't have any qualifications at all, you know, in the field of web design.
Because of the tech bubble.
The tech bubble, yeah,
more or less. If you knew Photoshop and you could...
If you knew Photoshop and anything else, and if you just knew one iota more than the next guy, you know, you were in. So, I mean, I just wasn't that concerned about it, honestly. And, you know, I was young and idealistic and... more interested in exploring philosophical notions that I think actually continue to influence me now. I mean, I'm also a painter and artist, and I think through the same issues today in one way or another. And so, my long story short, my master's thesis was a small building / video installation, I suppose, that was accompanied by a pretty substantial paper, 50, 60 pages, and it really was all about...
You built a building?
Well, yeah, sort of. The whole project was based around the question of what happens at the intersection of digital space and physical space. And through all kinds of fancy philosophical gymnastics, I landed on a certain term or a philosophical concept that comes from a woman named Julia Kristeva, which is abjection, and it's the notion of abject subjectivity. So subjectivity was really the answer that I provided, and there's all kinds of Lacanian psychoanalysis surrounding this. The paper was really long and probably very dry to most people, but really exciting to me at the time. And but the output of that was really a video installation that I built in the top floor of the Skiles Breezeway. I got permission from the department to do this. Right in the middle there. I actually spent like an entire summer building it in pieces that would snap together.
And then you assembled it.
And then I assembled
it. So what were the dimensions of the finished product?
Oh, I think, gosh, it was probably about 10 by 18 or 20 and picked up off of the ground by 2 feet and probably had essentially the walls were basically 10 feet tall, 8 feet to 10 feet tall.
So was this a plywood structure that you
it was a giant art installation. Not giant. It was a self-contained site, unspecific, and that was actually sort of important. They could be put anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
A video installation that echoed a lot of the fixtures and circulation of water and so on that you would find in, say, a bathroom.
Okay.
Which I realize is very strange. I mean, we could talk about this for a long time, and you probably still wouldn't understand at the end unless I showed you some photographs. But that had video circulating in it, and there was all kinds of ambitious stuff that never happened around sensors and that kind of thing that you know, that would trigger all kinds of stuff. But essentially, that's what I did, and I built it up there, and they passed me along, and you know, I was at the time heavily influenced not just by digital art which I've actually never really had much of a taste for, other than some video artists like Bill Viola, etc.
Digital art meaning simply art that's created using digital media?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, I like Bill Viola, I like some video artists, but I'm not particularly impressed or especially not then, wasn't particularly impressed by net art or digital art that existed out there, although I think that's changed. I mean, there's been quite a bit of time that's passed since then.
At the time, everyone was so excited at the cool things
you
could
just
do, right?
Anything. Exactly. I mean, and so those things are maybe historically important, but to me, not particularly exciting.
Okay.
Or evocative, which is something I think is important with art.
And did you end up getting a job with your master's thesis?
No, I didn't end up getting a job with my master's thesis. I did, nonetheless, get a job with a very large corporation here that is global, but they have offices here in Atlanta. And I worked for them for 11 years.
What were you doing?
I was, currently my title is a user experience director. But
at the same
no,
place?
No, no, no. I have since changed jobs fairly recently in the last year or so. But for a long time, when I was with this large company, I was what's called an information architect. And, you know, that's just what the title was.
Is that ironic to you that this job that you got blended?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think when I got out of graduate school and I was like 24 or whatever, I was sort of proud of that, honestly, you know, that I managed to sort of keep that word in my title. And certainly the job itself is very similar to the actual job of being an architect. When a lot of those folks that were in my studio, I think I mentioned even some of the ones from my very first quarter at Tech remain my friends today. And I talk to them obviously less frequently than I used to, but when we talk about, when we do talk and we talk about work, we speak the same language for certain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of that, of how they connect still?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's all about, you're always building something, right, in both of these jobs. Mm-hmm. Like an information architect essentially designs software applications / web applications / websites with an eye towards usability and sustainability and, you know, design in general. You're not a graphic designer. You're not a creative person. Creative, and I just made quote marks in that sense, but you have to always be sort of five steps ahead of the user in any given time is the way I feel about it. And architects think in the same manner. And I think my architecture education certainly prepared me for that very well.
Okay. So you've been an information architect, did you say, for 11 years?
Well, it's more like 12 or 13.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And when did the painting arrive?
Well, painting really started for me as an outgrowth of that time when I was doing my master's thesis and thinking about getting a job. I really admired art, and I admired a lot of painters and artists that were not painters, specifically like Joseph Beuys. I really admired Robert Rauschenberg and Anselm Kiefer at the time, and still do. Gerhard Richter, several people. I was just fascinated by them. And, you know, I got out of there, and I got a job and had some money. I was one of the poorest kids on the block when I was all through school. And I had some money and could, like, go places now. And painting is expensive, but I decided I was going to do it on the cheap and use materials from Home Depot, like Rust-Oleum and plaster and roofing tar and caulk and anything like that, in addition to oil paints and stuff. So I just decided I wanted to do it. I had a little money now, you know, to spend on hobbies, basically. And that's where it started, but it quickly became something more than a hobby.
How?
Well, I mean, I would go home and just do it every night. That's what I would do all the time.
And was that because, well, why was that? What was the draw? No pun intended.
Art is, for me at least, and I hate talking like this in a way because it sounds so pretentious to me, but the being compelled to make something, whether it be with your hands using tools like paintbrushes or hammers or you know, to use a computer, to me is kind of an attempt to embody the way one thinks and feels about the world, right? Implicitly, right? And for me, I was fascinated less by the immaterial aspects of digital media and more fascinated by the, how to put this, the ways in which our lives were already sort of virtualized prior to digital media, and the way that the physical world can erupt into that space in a moment. And back in the day, back in that time, I think this doesn't happen so much anymore, but the way, you know, computer crashes used to happen all the time, right. You know, or bugs, you know, things
and
like that.
Is that what your master's thesis was about?
Yeah, in many ways, yeah. Yeah. It was, it's, that concept was implicit throughout the entire thing.
And so do you, how do you bring that to a painting? I mean, because certainly when I first think painting, I'm afraid I have a very square view, I think.
Well, you
basically
think,
oil on a canvas.
Yeah, oil on canvas, flat. Sailboats.
And, yeah.
Or maybe some abstract stuff like maybe with Jackson Pollock or someone like that. Yeah. I'm certainly, I think about that stuff as well. But I don't think of it as a representational activity in the sense of taking a photograph, right? I'm not interested in photorealistic painting.
Okay.
Nor am I interested in sort of decorative abstract painting as well. I'm interested in the meat of the artifact itself and the materiality of it and the way that materiality can have its own concepts, right? It's a kind of a phenomenological thing. Like an architect, Louis Kahn, used to say, you have to ask a brick what it wants to be.
You have to ask a brick what it wants to be?
Yeah, Louis Kahn was saying that essentially the brick will tell you what it can do, right? Michelangelo said that David was locked in the marble. You know, that becomes sort of a cliche, but I think there's some truth to that. Materiality has its own concepts.
How did the roofing tar and the Rust-Oleum enter into that equation?
Well, I mean, I thought roofing tar would be an interesting material to paint with. It's very viscous and thick, and it dries very slowly, whereas oil paint, Rust-Oleum, acrylic, these things all dry at different rates. And mixed together, they'll probably torque one another and do some surprising, unexpected things.
Now, what does that mean when you say they'll torque one another?
Well, I mean, if you have one substance that dries at a certain rate and another substance that dries quicker, right, cracks will, if they're mixed together, cracks will happen.
Right.
That's
they're
one.
Pulling away from each other. It's making
things will separate or pull away or mix in ways that you can, in chemical reactions can sometimes happen, which I've managed not to do anything dangerous so far. I mean, you really have to kind of like look and do some research sometimes to, you know, find out what's going to happen.
Have you found anybody? You said research. I know that meant, you know, chemical combinations. Yeah. But have you found anybody who was doing this before you in painting? Has anybody else used roofing tar and?
Oh, I mean, those are just materials. I think there have definitely been people who have kind of had similar ideas about painting to me. Yeah. You know, but I mean, I don't think the material. I don't think anyone's ever used those materials per se. I could be wrong though.
And are those people who have similar ideas, are they coming from the same kind of background, the same kind of architecture or digital media or both kind of background?
No, I mean, most of the people, I actually mostly admire the work of the mid-20th century avant-garde and then getting into the late 80s and early 90s avant-garde as well. But I also have moved away from the idea of the avant-garde as some kind of utopian project, which a lot of those people still adhere to. Basically because I felt like, I feel like today the avant-garde in art is just kind of riding a cultural wave and really riding it. I mean, really just going along, mm-hmm. right? Rather than, in a lot of ways, the modernist architects did this as well. I mean, everyone always pretends like they were revolutionary, but really the technologies were revolutionary and they promoted them. And now we live in the world that they promoted, frankly.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You know, that's up to you. I mean, I have my own judgments, but I think everybody has to kind of make that call on their own.
All right, well, let's take a break for a moment. We can all make that call, and then we'll be back talking with Mark Denard some more about painting and Rust-Oleum, I think.
Yeah.
Listen to Just Jazz on WREK every weekday morning from 9 till noon. You'll hear old jazz, new jazz, hot jazz, cool jazz, free jazz, unfree jazz, jazz fusion, and of course, jazz fission. It's all part of our commitment to quality, diverse music. That's Just Jazz. Come celebrate a century of musical genius every Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta.
Okay, and we're back with the North Avenue Lounge. My guest is Mark Denard, a Georgia Tech alumnus, and we were talking about painting and the avant-garde, and there was, I think, a moment where we maybe critiqued the utopian project of the avant-garde. I don't know what that means, but...
I mean, I think all of it is a kind of an implicit critique of that, although I don't make a big deal out of it. I don't make a fuss.
So, is painting completely separate from your career as an information architect?
Yes and no. I mean, certainly the activity of painting is very different from the activity of designing a software application or a website. One requires one to have design itself as distinct from art, the fine arts and what I consider to be art, which is something that can be much more sublime. You know, it requires a certain amount of conscious activity, you know, organization. It requires a lot of talking to clients. You're almost always building something for someone rather than for yourself or for the world at large, you know. So they're pretty different.
Yeah. So how does your painting fit into the Atlanta art scene?
At the moment, I don't think it does at all.
No.
Well, I spent years on the road when I worked for that 11 years I worked for this big corporation. I spent, out of 11 years, probably, if you total all the time I was on client sites out of state and not here in Atlanta where I live, I think I was probably on the road about half that time.
Okay.
So, like, I spent 2 years in New York on a couple of different projects. I spent, 9 months in Red Bank, New Jersey here, 6 months in Boston there, you know, 3 months in South Bend, Indiana there.
Were you able to paint when you were on the road?
Not when I was on the road so much, although you could do small things. I would, you know, I did often bring, like, a little sketchbook or something. But also when you're on the road, you work all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would be in a hotel room, you know, building process flows or navigational flows or wireframes or whatever in the evenings. And then the rest of the time, you know, for me, painting is not an activity in which I use to unwind. It's not leisure for me. It's not therapeutic. It's not like that for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I do gear up for, and it is a struggle, and I like it that way.
Can you describe how painting is a struggle?
Well, sure. I mean, I could probably induce the feeling of anxiety on you by giving you a white canvas and saying, go.
No, I don't want you to do that. Yeah, I don't want that.
but you know, there's, for me, I often think about subject matter and try to articulate that subject matter on the canvas and fail every time. And it obviously then becomes something on its own, and I try to work and have a dialogue with the piece itself then, so that it can become what it wants to be. And I hate to sound mystical there, like it, but that really is what happens. And I think it's a very material process.
Meaning that the stuff that you're doing, the actual paint and the canvas tells you?
Yeah.
Okay, big quote marks around tells and wants and all that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The paint on the canvas guides the next...
Oftentimes it'll guide the next move. And for me, that's kind of where it's at. So to answer your original question, I don't really fit into the Atlanta art scene at the moment. I've had one small show here and there, but for me, it's mostly about the work, or has been up to now.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously there are plenty of things I like to do with my time, but one of my favorite things to do is to put on something like Pandora or something like that and paint from 6:30 when I get home until 3:30 in the morning.
How did the art show, how did that compare to the juries when you were in architecture school or presenting to a...
compared to the juries, the show that I did, which was not in a gallery, it was in a loft here in Atlanta somewhere, not an official gallery. I mean, it was a bit of a cakewalk. I was frankly surprised that it was fairly well received by the people who came, meaning people did... I often assume that silence means either astonishment, which I think sometimes happens with my work, but, or instead of astonishment, just
I got nothing to say about this, right? Mm-hmm. But I had a lot of people come up and tell me that they really liked it, and that was nice. It is nice to be validated. They're paintings, they're visual artifacts, and they need to be seen.
Right.
That's what they're for. Otherwise, I could write something down or just, you know, sit and imagine things all the time. But, you know, so it was pleasant compared to those juries, which were, for me, often, as I described, a bit antagonistic and combative. And I always felt like I was fighting the good fight, essentially. But in that show that I had, it didn't feel that way at all. It felt like a bunch of nice people coming and looking at stuff on the walls, which is what they were doing.
Is that the end of a painting once someone sees it? Have you completed it, or is it completed before people see it?
No. There's stuff that I've shown that I'm positive I'm going to keep working on and maybe even destroy by painting over.
Yeah. Is that good? Is that bad? What does it mean?
I don't know. I mean, everyone that I know that I tell that to, you know, we're like, well, why don't